Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Welcome to the Strategy and Insider podcast. In this podcast series, we aim to explore some of the most critical future trends, as we will be discussing them with industry experts and also actually leading practitioners from various different industry sectors. During our conversations, we will make you familiar with key developments by actually taking you behind the scenes of those practitioners and provide you with insights that we think really matter. Together with our guests of each of those episodes, we want to better understand both the opportunities and the challenges ahead of the change that we are experiencing in various parts of our lives. In our first season, we will discuss some of the most fundamental and critical questions in the healthcare industry. And the future of healthcare will be digitally enabled and data-driven. It will be way more personalized and in the hands of people. It will be way more preventative and also more and more integrated into everyday life. And while technology in other areas like how we shop, how we bank, how we travel has shown tremendous impact already, the impact yet on healthcare is not that big, especially when looking in what is already possible. That's why in our podcast series, we look behind the scenes of what's going on towards that future of health, discussing those topics, the opportunities and the challenges with top executives from pharma, from medtech and others, but also leading academics, healthcare practitioners, and also new kids on the healthcare block, talking about technology players, be it big or be it small. My name is Thomas Solbach, and I'm very happy to host the first season of this Strategy and Insider podcast. I'm a partner at Strategy and out of the Frankfurt office, leading anything to do with commercial in the pharma life sciences industry. And in my daily job, I'm working collaborating with leading pharmaceutical, biotech, and also other healthcare companies in building game-changing and differentiating strategies, but also the capabilities needed in order to live up to those strategies. And in that regard, we just completed our recent study on the future of healthcare. And during that, what really surprised me is that, a lot of change will happen, a lot of opportunities will arise, but also a lot of challenges will occur and confront existing players as well as new entrants in order to make that future of health a reality. That's why I'm very thrilled to have Dr. Andreas Wicki with me today, who is the chief oncologist of the Kantonsspital Basel-Land here in Switzerland and has more than 12 years experience as working as an oncologist. And Andreas and I, we met a good 3 years ago on a joint project around precision oncology, and ever since have been talking about what will the future in oncology, but healthcare more broadly, look like. So thanks very much, Andreas, for taking the time and having that discussion with me today.
Thomas, thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here as well.
So, we talk about the future of healthcare, but before doing that, probably also digging a little into you and knowing you quite some time now, knowing admittedly that oncology is a very tough area to work in and being confronted with deadly diseases on a daily basis. I mean, how can you actually switch off for pleasure and leisure at after work, but also coming here and having a podcast on the future of healthcare?
Well, you're right. Oncology is kind of a tough business. On the other hand, I think we have a very close relationship to our patients, which may be much closer than in other areas of medicine. And believe it or not, you know, an oncology consultation can be much more cheerful than what you imagine. So many patients, you know, they don't want to talk about the disease all the time. Okay. So many consultations may just be talking about, you know, what did you get to lunch yesterday? And then obviously, you know, there are the difficult situations, patients who just have got bad news. These are the situations where sometimes you do take a little bit of what you do in your daily life back to your home. but that's part of the job. I think it's not something I would like to get rid of.
So it's kind of being a oncologist means caring about the disease and treatment options, but being a psychologist at the same time and someone to where a patient can lean towards.
It's being a bit a psychologist as well, but mostly it's just about, you know, knowing people sometimes for many years, and in a way being a little bit part of their life.
That's a good thing to have in mind. But I mean, when you started back, when was it, 11, 12, 13
12 years ago?
12 years ago. I mean, have you experienced some change since in oncology?
Well, the changes in oncology have been huge. I can give some examples. You know, when you look at lung cancer, for example, mm-hmm. non-small cell lung cancer, 12 years ago, we had three different therapies, and you could choose to give one of those.
Okay.
Nowadays, just for first line, we have to choose between, let's say, 20 different therapeutic options. 12 years ago, biology didn't really play a role. It was histology. So the pathologist told you this is a specific histology, and that's the therapy you will give. Nowadays, we do sequencing, we look at immunohistochemistries. So there's a whole bunch of biological assessments which happen. Mm-hmm. Which determine what therapy is given afterwards. So in a way, there are more decisions to take. That's certainly a big difference.
And can I just probe into that? If oncology has more options to choose from and more diagnostics to cope with, it is getting way more complex than in the past. How does that relate to you being kind of the psychologist? How much time can you actually dedicate to the patient rather than understanding the complexity and maneuvering that?
So you're right, it's become much more complex. And perhaps before we come to the question of how to maneuver that, I think, you know, the uncertainty in a way has increased. Uh-huh. Because 12 years ago, usually if you've got metastatic disease, you knew there were some therapeutic options, uh-huh. But it's finally a deadly disease.
Yeah.
Nowadays, there are more therapeutic options, but uncertainty, will I survive or will I succumb to this disease, is much bigger than that.
Mm.
Nowadays, we may have 1 in 5 patients surviving long term. Mm-hmm. And I cannot predict who's that going to be.
Yeah.
So this means discussing with patients, although we have more options, which... You know, it's fabulous that we've got more options. But the incertitude and the choices we have to make have become more difficult than 10 or 12 years ago. Mm.
So meaning that there is more options to choose from. It's getting more complex. It's driving hope of people, yeah, because it can still be a deadly disease, but probably it's not for the very patient specifically. Yeah. And that drives uncertainty.
For most patients, it still is a deadly disease.
Yeah.
But you now have the choice. You know, do you go for aggressive therapy, which gives you a certain chance of becoming a chronic cancer patient? Although you choose to go for more palliative, somewhat less aggressive treatment, but diminishing your chance to have chronic disease. That's a choice we didn't have 10 or 12 years ago.
So you can do it more precise and more personalized to the very patient, it seems.
Yeah, no? Definitely.
Okay. And this is also where we met each other, right? And drive that personalization to the next level. Andreas, in the future of health study, and we... obviously had discussions before that and during the study, but we also had discussions around one of the outcomes that we found in the survey is that there will be massive impact on what you and other providers might be doing in future, given the fact that if we have more data, if we have better means to understand how people are getting sick or stay healthy, there will be a push towards prevention and digital solutions that keep people prevented and healthy. So you did nicely comment on that, that this will have a massive impact on your role as a doctor. Probably, can you elaborate on that a little further on how your role might be changing in future?
The classical conception of a doctor was... you need to know how to diagnose a disease and you need to know how to treat it. Mm-hmm. So basically it's about knowledge. Mm-hmm. So you go to med school, to learn these two things, diagnostic and therapeutic measures. Now the knowledge is expanding very rapidly. So saying, well, I know everything, I can just decide what is the right way to go, it's not going to be a solution for the future. So learning facts, knowledge, is not no longer going to be the only or the key part in medical training. Basically, you need to learn how to gather information and to weigh that information. There are so many different pieces of information, and for a patient it's very difficult to understand whether that's a piece of information which is relevant to this specific situation or it is not. And I think that's a role the doctor will fulfill in the future, and they need to be trained for that as well.
And how much time can you actually dedicate of your very busy schedule, seeing patients, managing that complexity, being a psychologist, how much time can you actually dedicate to stay ahead of state-of-the-art research and knowledge gathering that's happening as we speak in the medical community?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a big challenge. I mean, even if you dedicate a few hours a week to reading journals, you're never going to be able to cope with all the information which is out there. And it's not just about the medical knowledge and reading clinical trials. It's also about biology information. So doing a sequencing, having 140 or 400 different genes, you will never be able to understand what the different mutations mean, how they interact with each other. So we need to find a solution where we can pull together the information, make sense out of it, and come up with a recommendation for our patients.
And do you have for yourself already a solution on how you can do that and how you kind of keep up with that information? Is there something out there that you can use, or do you do kind of spot education on certain topics?
It's not a technical issue. You know, it's not just about writing a software. It's because we need to do true prediction. What is the best therapy? We need to do true prediction. What are side effects of a therapy if I'm going to use that one? And such algorithms which take into account the information which is there, they need to be tested also in a clinical setting. And that's something which has not been done so far. So there's not really a single trial out there showing that a certain algorithm will be better than another one. So it's a future which we still have to develop.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I recently came across an example of something called BioMind AI system, which is a university-based system, as far as I understand it. And they did go head-to-head against, they call it allied doctors in China, in who is better at diagnosing brain tumors from MRI scans. Surprisingly or not, you call it as whatever you would like to, but the AI that was set up and previously trained did come up with 87% right answers in 15 minutes for something north of 200 patients, while really a big bunch of allied doctors did come up with only 66% right answers in 30 minutes. So taking longer time to come up with less good results. I mean, is that an indication of we need that algorithm, that AI helping us to decide in future, or do you have big doubts there?
No, I think, frankly, I don't have doubts about that. The results you just explained, you know, diagnosing a certain disease is something which we have seen the last two or three years, that artificial intelligence is getting better than doctors. It was an example with brain tumors, but for we do have data, for example, for melanoma. So for black skin cancer, machines are better in diagnosing black skin cancer than dermatologists. So, you know, making sense out of images is probably the field where artificial intelligence is really ahead today already compared to doctors. So radiology, but also inspection, skin inspection, for example, these are topics which are pretty easily covered by artificial intelligence. And I would expect that's something we're going to see in the next few years, that we will have automatic systems to look into this. So for example, at University Hospital in Basel, they are building a new system where you can have 360 degrees of photographs taken of the skin and then an algorithm which identifies the different skin lesions. So that's something which is already moving slowly into clinical practice. It's still research, but I expect it to move into practice within the next few years. What we haven't seen so far is a trial testing prediction of therapy. So a trial looking at biology and then saying, well, based on this biology, that's the most promising treatment. You have the highest chance of success and the lowest chance of having adverse events. That's something we haven't seen yet. And you know, when you think of oncology, for example, or other entities, hematological malignancies and so on, the bigger challenge still lies in predicting the correct therapy and not the correct diagnosis. So we can diagnose more than 90% of cancers correctly. But if the question is, you know, how many patients are going to respond to a given therapy, for many therapies it's still 50% or 60% or sometimes 70%, and that's considered to be good. So we're far away from an accurate prediction of response probability.
And I'm doubtful whether we will ever get to 100% correct judgment, also knowing that even today we have weaknesses in our system and we're not reaching 100% yet, otherwise we wouldn't need anything else, of course. But did I get that right, that in order to trust these algorithms to make sense or to be accepted as a decision-making tool, they need to be validated in your eyes in clinical settings where you kind of have a head-to-head between a machine versus a set of doctors predicting a disease or predicting an outcome or predicting, sorry, not a disease, but a response to a treatment or side effects that is then head-to-head kind of tested against the doctor's decision.
Yes, definitely. I mean, again, an example. At the Cantonal Hospital in Basel-Land, we do have a molecular tumor board. Mm-hmm. So we look at the biology, do the sequencing, immunohistochemistry, FISH analyses, and so on. And then we gather all data on mutations, on expression patterns, and so on. But finally, it's a group of doctors who need to decide what therapy is given. Mm-hmm. And this comes with a price. The price is we ignore or disregard all information which we cannot weigh. Mm-hmm. So if we don't know what it means, we will just disregard it. Mm-hmm. So if we really want to make use of all the information which has become available already through new means of testing, NGS, next generation sequencing, for example, but also through big data, looking at large patient cohorts and clinical outcomes, we will need to have some support there, because otherwise we will get stuck with using just a very small fraction of the knowledge which is available.
And even if these tools would be available, now, also a little self-critique here. I'm also a medic by train, but have we really been trained to use these tools to understand where data is coming from, how algorithms work? Are doctors prepared during their studies in the right way as we're seeing that? Because you're also teaching at the university hospital. I mean, do you have the sense this is already there? It's on the curriculum or do we need to change there as well?
Well, I think it's moving. So universities have started to build programs. So there are programs, also postgraduate programs, for example, for personalized molecular oncology. We've just run the first course in our institution. But basically, you know, I think these algorithms, once they are tested in a clinical trial, the difference is not so big compared to what we are doing nowadays. Mm-hmm. If you do a test now, you measure one gene, and then you predict what the therapy is. Nobody says the machine is telling you what you have to do. If you say, I have to look it up in the book, nobody says, oh, well, the book is telling you what you have to do. So if we look at it rather from the perspective, it's a more complex testing, and then the algorithm comes up with a series of proposals, it's not so very different from what we are doing nowadays. And I think doctors will be ready to embrace that once it has been tested in clinical trials. As
once there is that trust into the current black box
exactly.
of an algorithm. Yeah. Huh? Okay.
Yeah, but the black box, even if you have a drug, you look at preclinical data. Sometimes we find out later on that the mechanism which was predicted is completely wrong. So testing a drug in a clinical setting can be something like a black box. That's why you test it in the empirical setting, because you can really demonstrate there's a benefit of doing this therapy. And for the algorithm, it's exactly the same. Even though it may to a certain degree be a black box, as long as you can prove it improves outcomes, doubts will be much smaller.
Yeah. And still, once on the market, also there, something can happen still, right?
Sure. But basically, you know, you would test the algorithms as you do drugs. So first against guidelines and then against another algorithm. And it's a new series of trials testing algorithms one against the other.
That future of healthcare sounds very promising in terms of us getting more empowered, getting more preventative solutions that are taking advantage of globally available insights and data and more integrated into our normal lives. But it's not there yet. It's not a reality yet. What are the things that you think are required to make that future a reality?
Well, basically, I think that the different players, including, for example, regulators, healthcare providers, but also, let's call them prediction providers, you know, handling information and giving prediction. We need these different players around the table, and we need them to discuss how regulation is to look like for this prediction. And this regulation is going to be different than the regulation we see now for approving drugs, for example. We need to know what the business model is behind that. What about patents? You know, can we have patents then on these predictions? Or is it more like a CE grade? Is it a medical device in the end? I think these are discussions we should have and find the spot where we can place these artificial intelligence predictions and these new models so that they can benefit patients.
And also a key question is who's taking the risk if there is a prediction wrong? Yeah, and who is taking liabilities could also be.
But the risk, so the question concerning the risk is very easy. The risk lies with the patient. If there's no response, then there's a malefit for the patient. Liability is much more difficult, you know, because so far as a physician, you do a prediction. If you're wrong, you're not liable. You're just wrong. If we do elaborate prediction models based on AI and the rate of prediction is going to be higher, and you can demonstrate the rate of prediction is higher than what your physician predicts, I think it's going to be the same. I mean,
still the doctor would be liable in that response, or would the AI provider, the prediction provider, then be reliable for it?
Yeah, but I think basically, you know, you need to show you did the best prediction you could. That's what you need to show as a physician. That's what you need to show as an AI. If you did that and you proved to be wrong, I think it's not a question of liability. And I guess we will not get to the point where we will have 100% response rate. That's not going to happen. I mean, science argues against that.
Yeah.
Let's be frank. But I mean, what is the liability if, for example, you know, the algorithm is messed up? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, it's the same question as asking for who is liable if there's a self-driving car. Then in some way, the producer plays a role in that, whether the liability lies completely with you know, the company responsible for the algorithm, or it's a shared liability, I don't know.
But surely, just listening to our conversation, discussion around it, you can have different perspectives on exactly those elements, right? And they are important to be discussed, aligned, and ironed out. And I mean, your kind of call for action is here. Let's group around a round table. Let's have all the ones having an interest around the well-being of people and patients at the table and have the big ticket questions discussed.
And I think it's very important to do that and to do it pretty soon, because we want to have innovative industry in this field. And if the industry shies away from the field because, you know, legal questions are not resolved, this will just slow down the field. So we should make sure patients will have benefit of this information, of these new technologies soon.
And my personal opinion here is, I mean, innovation will not stop because we are not getting our head around those questions, right? If something is possible, it will happen eventually somewhere in the world. So getting our head around that is required, and we should not shy away from the complexity. Yes.
Yeah,
by all means, it is complex, but if we can't solve it, now taking a European perspective here, if we can't solve it, we just need to live with realities that are made elsewhere, I guess.
We want to trust into the solutions. Yeah. In order to be able to trust in the solutions, we need to be part of the solution. Otherwise, you know, the solution is kind of produced somewhere else, and then it's take it or leave it. And I think it's not a nice perspective as a patient to have the choice, well, you can use it. We don't really know what it does. But if you don't, there's nothing else. So I think that's the wrong way to go.
So just anticipating that we would have predictive algorithms that give us means to decide upon or just take that decision and implement that with your patient. Is there a risk of a doctor becoming kind of a more of a mechanic who's just implementing a decision that was made somewhere else?
Well, I would guess, you know, many people are indeed afraid of that perspective because they feel they're going to lose kind of, self-determination, so they're not able to choose anymore. But I think it's wrong. I mean, nowadays you do a test, you do a lab test, or you do, you know, again, sequencing. And then basically you open your textbook, either physically or you just got your textbook in your mind, and you know the trial, so you know what there is to do. If you change this into a formal algorithm and there's a software instead of your textbook, I frankly don't see really a big difference. In the end, I would hope the algorithm will give us a list, a ranked list, which is the best therapeutic options there are. And then we need to consider side effects. You know, if the first drug on the list has a side effect which is not acceptable to the patient, we need to move to the second drug. And that's not principally different from what we are doing nowadays. So The next question is, you know, would you like to have a doctor which disregards 90% of the information and tells you what you need to do? Or would you like to have an algorithm taken into account, I don't know, 50%, 60%, whatever we will get to, and then the doctor counseling you on what the best therapy is?
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Maybe a rhetorical question, but
for me personally,
the answer is very clear.
No, absolutely. And to me personally, I think it heavily depends on what we're talking about. I mean, would I be happy to read on a computer screen, oh, Thomas, you have a flu? I would be happy to take this, right? But would we be happy to read on a screen, oh, sorry, but you have non-small cell lung cancer, without their a physical person, a well-trained, a well-experienced doctor being there who can psychologically support you in that very moment? I would have my feeling to that, right? So a flu might be okay,
definitely.
But if we talk something serious, it might not be so okay.
But I think that's really a difference. You know, the algorithm giving you the best therapeutic options is something which will not really change the relationship between a patient and the doctor. Having a machine giving you the diagnosis and proposing therapy, that's something completely different.
Yeah. Yeah. In principle, the principle, so to say, will stay the same as long as AI-driven decision-making is tested in a comparable way that drugs are tested today, probably quicker. I don't know, but they need to have kind of a rigid system behind that backs up. It is something to trust.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We recently came across our German Minister of Health, Jens Spahn, commenting on cancer and saying something in the range of cancer will soon be curable, which obviously was something that was covering media throughout and probably also didn't make stop at the oncologist level. So posing that question with someone who is working day in, day out in cancer and oncology, is that statement valid? Will cancer soon be curable, slash, based on the future of health, also be preventable?
You know, politicians have declared war on cancer already several decades ago.
Is that?
President Nixon has done this already. And so far, it's not proven to be right. I think the situation has changed because, you know, let's say 15 years ago, long-term survivors of metastatic cancer were very rare. So if you could not do surgery, then usually there was no long-term survival. This has changed. So we've got new sets of therapies, targeted agents, but also immunotherapy agents. And nowadays, we guess that 1 in 5 patients will get into a chronic phase. Whether this means cure, we cannot say yet because the new drugs are there since 7 or 8 years. So nobody can say what happens after 20 years or 30 years. But for some compounds, we do have data for 10 years and people who've been treated are free of relapse for many years. And I mean, you know, if you do an educated guess, you would say there's a good chance that they will be cured at some point. But first, it's still a minority. It's 20%. And we don't, you know, the other 80% still will at some point die from malignant disease. And on the other hand, we do not yet have real long-term outcomes. So we don't know how it looks like after 20 years, 30 years. And we don't know what it means in terms of side effects, long-term side effects. You know, if you really get cured, then what is the price? Do you have more cardiovascular disease? Do you have more kidney disease? At least for cancers of children, it has been shown. For example, the chance of getting a hip replacement is 50 times the chance of somebody who did not suffer from childhood cancer. That's something you would not predict easily.
It's not because, obvious.
You know, why do you think of hip replacement in the setting of cancer and chemotherapy?
As an oncologist, any suggestion for us as the normal society on how we could prevent oncology situations, cancer situations in future? Is there anything... The 3 or 5 things that we should stop doing?
Well, there are some very easy things and there are difficult things. So, I mean, stopping to smoke is an easy...
Okay, tick.
It's something, you know, we've been knowing for 30 or 40 years. So it's very clear. Yeah. It has a huge impact. 100 years ago, lung cancer was described as a very rare disease. Mm-hmm. And we can get back to having lung cancer, a very rare disease, if we quit smoking. But other things are much more difficult. You know, for example, people guess that, you know, healthier food could have an impact. The largest trial ever run in Europe was almost 500,000 people for 9.7 years. And they looked at the incidence of cancer, and the difference was between 2 and 3%. So there may be a certain impact, but the impact is not huge.
Stopping to smoke is much more preventative.
Has much more impact than, for example, changing your habits, what you eat. It's not the same if you look at cardiovascular disease. So the risk of getting a heart attack, whatever, was decreased by around 30%. But there was a small difference for cancer. So, you know, the question is, can we really... get rid of all risk factors for cancer. So when people switched from one type of cigarette to cigarettes with filters, for example, the rate of one type of lung cancer dropped and the rate of another lung cancer histology increased. So some events probably just happen. They are stochastic. So I'm not sure we really can get rid of all risk factors.
It does ring a bell in my head, at least, and obviously oncology is different from cardiovascular diseases, from neurodegenerative diseases, and you name them. But if we look into that future of healthcare, things will be much more data-driven, AI-enabled, more preventative, more at the customer's fingertips rather than the patient's itself, helping themselves via digital health solutions, so on and so forth. Who is going to drive that change in your eyes? Because you have the traditional players, the academics, the providers, the payers, the pharma industry, the medtech industry, that have humongously big knowledge in healthcare and how to kind of work and maneuver in that highly regulated market. And at the same time, you're having the new kids on the healthcare block, at least big tech entering big times, and just looking at the usual suspects like an Alphabet, an Amazon, an Apple, if we talk about the US, or an Alibaba and a Tencent from the Chinese side. I mean, they have been massively putting efforts in entering the space when it comes to M&A and partnering and joint ventures, but also when talking about patent filings. I mean, those five that I just mentioned, they by now already own more than 6,000 health-related patents. So where do you see that happening first? Is it more the traditional players? Is it more the tech players or anything in between?
Now, I don't think that the tech companies will anytime soon really go into the development of completely new drugs. I mean, there's a lot of science behind that. They could do that. They do have the money to do it, but they also need the people to do it.
But they could at the same time probably go into prevention of it, right?
But they could go into prevention. That's one thing I think they will do as well. And the other one is they will go into prediction. Mm-hmm. Which in a way is going to be, you know, when you look at classical phase 3 trials, so doing real prediction could be something which takes the place of phase 3 trials at some point.
So basically, bottom line is they might not enter the highly regulated drug development market so much when talking about innovative drugs, where we have development cycles of 10 to 12 years, but more into fast-paced data and algorithm-based solutions in healthcare, which is more close to what they are used to do now. And why shouldn't they be good in predicting certain diseases or outcomes when they can predict? And it's not like for like here, but if they can predict what we are about to buy next without us knowing what we are going to buy next. Yeah?
You know, if they are better in predicting what is the right therapy, it's fine. I mean, there's no rule why one company should do it and the other one should not. But they need to test it into a system which we trust in. It's difficult if you put out information without giving guidance on that.
But on that point, one question that I'm getting my head around that, at least, or driving my head around it, is looking into these Amazon, Uber, Airbnb and alike models. What they are doing is they are enablers. Yeah? They are choosing, this is the right product for you at the right time, and this is the right taxi that is next to you that drives you from A to B. So they are enabling by connecting a customer to someone who provides something, and they are getting a margin or a cut of the price in the range of 20 to 30%. Yeah? Is that something that we are also going to see in healthcare, which is in a close to 11 trillion market, quite substantial and attractive business?
I'm sure they're going to try, and I'm sure this is going to be in a way beneficial, because we need to have, you know, kind of a new view on the whole system, including data. The question is, you know, if we say they are enabler, what are they enabling and what are they trading in? Is this information, or is this prediction, or is this drugs? That's not the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, entering the information market, that's obvious. I mean, that's what they have been doing already quite some time ago. Entering the prediction market, well, it's something they haven't really done yet. But I think that's something they will try. And if you see what models they've got, I mean, I'm really looking forward to see how these models will perform in a real-life healthcare setting. What I don't know is whether they will in any way at some point really go into trial. So that's something, you know, classical pharma industry has got no problems with it. They will do it at some point. But what are the tech companies going to do? Are they ever going to run a trial on that? So that's really a question I would like to ask the people in charge.
Okay. But let me ask one final question then on this. If there would be such a marketplace for, let's call it healthcare solutions, be it a drug or be it a smart t-shirt or be it an app or be it whatever, yeah? If there is such a marketplace at some point that takes away the 20 to 30% cut, if you have one bet, which player would that be? Not talking about specific company names, but would that be rather someone from the traditional or rather someone from the non-traditionals or something completely different? One bet. I know, I make it hard now.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's a good question, but I think it really depends on whether, you know, if people paid out of the pocket, I would bet on the tech companies. Mm-hmm. Because that's very easy, you know. They can just do it. If people then buy it, it's fine. That's the deal. It's how it happens.
Yeah.
If it's going to stay in a highly regulated market and you will still have a gatekeeper who decides whether you receive actual therapy or treatment, then I'm a bit doubtful. Because if the regulation is going to stay, they will have to bow to the regulation. So either the regulation is gone or they will have to bow to the regulation. If they have to bow to the regulation, it means they need to run trials.
Yeah.
So it's either A or B.
Yeah, so they might even shy away from that regulation if needed.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So it might be tech, if out of pocket, if kind of the people are paying more themselves for it, but if it's continuing to be a highly regulated market, especially in the treatment setting, then it might be not them. Yeah.
I mean, the next question obviously is, you know, who would you trust your data? You know, would you give your data to the tech companies or to the pharma companies?
Who do you trust?
The choice is you. So this is one question I'm giving back to you.
Yeah, it's clearly someone, and that is a tough question. It is clearly someone who has the least personal or the least business interest in my data. This is where I would have the most trust. As soon as there is an individual interest of a company, of an organization to do something with that data, then trust is hampered. Yeah. So, but it's not a clear-cut answer, which is one side. And the other side is where I'm getting the best for me personally. Yeah. So even if it's a highly trustful organization that I'm entrusting my data with, if I'm not getting the best outcome for me in terms of healthcare, of staying healthy, not getting sick or getting the best treatment whenever in need for it, that I'm not trusting that company or that organization either. Yeah? So I want to have kind of a good balance of trust and neutrality at the same time paired with good outcomes and kind of return of data entrustment.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think as a society, you know, we in the end, we should ask that if we get information, if we get prediction, the end point, you know, what do we get out of it is a beneficial outcome. So in terms of health. Yeah. So it needs to be driven by endpoints which are, you know, related to health and not isolated by endpoints which are driven by economical considerations. And I think that's something that I guess society will ask for.
No, absolutely. And that's a very good ending, I have to say, with that statement. So what do we have as kind of the key takeaways of that session today? I think we clearly understood that oncology ever was complex, but is unseen complex in terms of the choices you have to make, the analytics and the data points that you need to integrate. That drives hope for people, but uncertainty at the same time, because who wants to be the one who is not getting the support needed? Second, AI is going to be needed, definitely.
Sure.
Because
you can't really
cope with what's going to be produced as we speak, and it will become the new normal in future. The good thing is that you're giving us hope that education of our doctors is on the right path. More to come. When talking about who is going to make that change happening, there might be a play for tech, especially in the area of where data is going to be needed, where predictions are going to be made, but they might be shying away from a highly regulated market or need to adapt to cope with that. So in essence, big changes are coming in healthcare for sure. Where they are coming from and how quick they are coming from, really here the race is open and only time will tell who's going to make that race. So Andreas, thanks a lot for your time, for sharing your thoughts. Very interesting and insightful. And I hope for everyone listening to that conversation, it was insightful and helpful to understand that perspective from a clinician, from an oncologist who's working in that space day in, day out. Stay tuned for our next series where we're going to take a different perspective next time, basically from the academic side, and I'm very much looking forward to discussing those insights and implications there. So thanks very much. Take care.
Strategy and Strategy made real.